Greeny with Mike Greenberg, the podcast.
All right, rolling along, Greeny with you on ESPN Radio. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. Couple of things we just heard from Christine in SportsCenter that I wanted to get into here, including the John Calipari stuff, which I think is interesting. So Calipari, after we reported on Sunday that he was leaving Kentucky to go to Arkansas, it wasn't announced for a little bit, and then he yesterday released a long video that I watched all of.
The dog video?
I somehow sat through all of it. No, long before the dog video, he was sitting on his couch. Did you not see this?
Yes, I just wouldn't make sure that I knew which video you were referencing.
Well, the dog video, he didn't confirm anything. But in the sitting on his couch video, he talked at extraordinary length about how much he loved Kentucky, how wonderful it had been there, how magnificent it was, how great everyone was to him. And he loved it so much that he was leaving immediately. And that there were a bunch of options out there for him, and they hadn't decided yet what they were going to do. They have to talk it over as a family.
Nice.
And today they have completed an extremely complicated long contract to become the coach at Arkansas, which includes a $7 million per year contract, a $1 million signing bonus, retention bonuses of $500,000 each year, and one-time bonuses for making the tournament, reaching the second round, the Sweet 16, the Final Four, and winning a national championship. Somehow they figured all that out after 5 o'clock in the afternoon yesterday.
I'm a little surprised. I'm a little surprised that he still wants to do it, to be honest with you.
Wants to do what?
That he still wants to coach college basketball. John Calipari, I would imagine, if he wanted to, could immediately have a pretty lucrative career in media. Do you agree?
For sure.
And I think if he wanted to, he could finally jump to the NBA just to see what it's all about. Do you agree?
He did do that once. Remember, he went to the Nets.
It's been a long time.
You're right.
I shouldn't act as if it had not happened before. But there have been many times he's gotten a raise over the years because an NBA job became available.
Yeah, because half the league played for him in college.
Of course. What I'm saying is, over the last 4 years, it's pretty clear that he's not done the job that well. And I think that's at least in part because he's not kept up with the times. I think most people agree on that. Why does he want to keep doing it at a much lesser than job? Arkansas basketball is merely an average Power 5 coaching job. So, he must just love it, but this struck me as an opportunity for Cal to try something new and try something different. So I'm a little surprised he wants to keep doing this.
Seth Greenberg yesterday predicted on Get Up that in 3 years, Calipari will have them in the Final Four. You take the over or the under on that?
Under. I disagree. I think John Calipari is very likely done doing any high-level winning like that.
See, I don't know about that. See, what I don't know is if the way he was doing it at Kentucky only worked at Kentucky, and again, to your point, doesn't work now, and he does adapt with the times. I mean, the great ones do. What we're going to find out now is if Calipari really is a great coach, because the great ones do. Look how many times Saban adapted with the times. Saban was winning championships with defense. He was fighting against the proliferation of offense, how many plays were being run, fast-paced, all that stuff. And you know what he did? He finally realized, this is what the sport is going to become, so I can either change with the times or I can lose. And he did it, and he adapted and all that. And then finally, this year, he decided, it has now changed in ways I don't feel like chasing anymore when I'm 72 years old. Cal is probably, 10 years younger than that?
65.
Okay, so he's younger than that, and he's a young-looking...
Yeah.
I'm surprised he's that old. Like, I know he's been around forever. He just doesn't look
61, excuse me.
No, he doesn't look 65. It doesn't make any difference.
Double-check that.
The point is, we're going to find out
65.
If he 65. Is able to adapt with the times.
So I don't want to divulge anything that he wouldn't be comfortable with me sharing on the air, because this was a conversation that we had off mic, but I was talking to Tim Legler about his observations from watching Kentucky basketball, and those are obviously John Calipari coached teams this year. And what he effectively said was, I'm consistently unimpressed with how well coached they look, how crisp they are coming out of timeouts, how organized they are on defense, like the basketball-y stuff. I have no doubt that John Calipari, especially given his $5 million budget, is going to be able to produce high-level talent out of Arkansas because he's going to get the best high school players like he always has. But if someone like Tim Legler is telling me that he sees a less than as a coach, like as an X's and O's guy, that matters more now than it used to, because you're not getting five stars every single year because the earth is flattened because of the NIL world.
But also, couldn't part of it be because he's getting all these young kids that they don't look as well coached because they are all so young. And that $5 million NIL pool now can go to players in the transfer portal. So he might be bringing in 20-year-olds and 21-year-olds to play for him for $1 million a year instead of 18-year-olds to play for him for $1 million a year. And maybe they will look more organized and well-coached.
I'll believe it when I see it. You're definitely onto something. That could definitely be the approach that he evolves to. But I've seen for the last 4 years, John Calipari become Dabo Sweeney. Go from being like the best coach minus Nick Saban to someone that you would definitely not hire to be the coach of your team now if you have an opening. Do you agree with that characterization of Dabo?
Well, it depends what my opening was.
Sure.
I, Alabama, there was a time when we thought he would be the obvious successor to Nick Saban.
That's a good point.
And that's not what happened.
No, and it could have. If he was still him.
Yeah, he went to Alabama.
For 4 years in the college landscape is a long time.
Yeah.
We've not seen Cal do it in a long time.
1 year in the world in which we live in every way has become a long time, in and outside of sports. So I think your point is a good one. We'll see. I think he's going to have the other thing is the definition of success at Arkansas is different from the definition of success at Kentucky. In Kentucky, if you're not in the Final Four, your season was a disaster. At Arkansas, if you are in the Final Four, they're ready to carry you out on their shoulders.
But didn't you just say that Seth Greenberg predicted Final Four for them?
Yes.
Yeah, and I disagree with that.
No, I mean, I get it.
He could get them to the Sweet 16, even though he couldn't get Kentucky there for the last 5 years, but I could see that.
I mean, Eric Musselman had them in Arkansas in the Elite Eight twice in the last four years.
What seeds were they, though? I feel like both of those teams exceeded their seed line. I want to remember that because they didn't make
it
far.
Where did Musselman go again?
USC.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not clear.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, they had a down year this year, but Arkansas basically is on their way back. They've been bad more or less since Nolan Richardson. But
right.
Musselman had them. They had four straight 21 seasons, Elite Eight, Elite Eight, Sweet 16.
Oh, you're right, Bubba.
They were down this year.
They were a 3 seed and a 4 seed in 21 and 22 and made it to the Elite Eight both times. That's a good call.
And there's more history there than that. Obviously, the 40 minutes of hell, if you're old enough to remember it, with Stroll and Nolan, and they won the championship and all that. They were great teams. But there is some history there. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the Sidney Moncrief Arkansas teams, and whatever. But your point is still not invalid, which is to say it's not Kentucky, it's never been Kentucky, and it's not likely ever to be Kentucky. So he is still interested in coaching, and my answer to you, am I surprised, is no, because that's what these guys do. It is in their blood. Krzyzewski didn't walk away from it until he didn't think he could do it anymore, and he didn't take a TV job. Miss Saban did. Football's a little different.
Yeah.
You know, it's not quite the same level of commitment. Jay Wright did. He's a younger person. We'll see. I will be very interested to see how that turns out. Greeny presented by Progressive Insurance. Looking for a career you will love with flexibility, great pay and benefits, and one of the country's top workplaces? Come join their growing team. Go to progressive.com/careers and apply online today.
The Scoop.
All right, something I found. I'm going to change course here from what's on the dock because I wanted to get into this. Something I found, Hembo, you brought up the other day, you got sort of called out by Gerrit Cole, the Yankees star pitcher, because you took great issue with Tony Clark, the head of the Baseball Players Association, basically blaming the proliferation of elbow injuries on the pitch clock. And you said, there's no obvious reason to think those two are connected together at all. And Gerrit Cole shot back at people saying that. I think he was talking to you. And so this morning, because Instagram knows me so much better than I know me, a video popped up on my feed from a site I do not follow and, in fact, have never heard of called Baseball Isn't Boring Podcast. There is a podcast called Baseball Isn't Boring. I didn't know it existed. But Ben McDonald was being interviewed on it, who was, I remember when he was like the dominant pitcher coming into the bigs. Is he a pitching coach now?
No, he does Orioles color, and he does stuff for the SEC Network for us.
Okay, fair enough.
He's
a broadcaster now. Mm-hmm. But he's as close to the game as you can be.
Oh, yeah.
And he had a very, very interesting take on what he is seeing as a pitcher himself with the arm injuries. Here's a little bit of what he said.
What's alarming in today's world for me is I feel like we're in a time where we're taking the best care of our pitchers that we ever have. And what I mean by that is limiting the pitches, limiting the innings that we throw, the recovery time, all those things. And yet it feels like we're in a time where we're losing more and more of our pitchers every day. I think pitching labs are very good, but I think they're the devil in some ways too, because now we know at the big league level what certain spins and shapes consistently get big league hitters out. We're trying to create those spins and shapes in these lefts. We'll bring them to the field. They're working, but I also feel like we're doing things that are unnatural to our arm. In other words, if we really pronate hard on the changeup and guys snap it over, trying to make that ball move like it did, maybe. I also think, obviously, and you know this, for 5 or 6 years now, we've been chasing velo. It's max effort. Yeah. It's get after it. Everything. We didn't pitch like that.
So he goes on. That's well edited by our group because you don't want to sit here for the whole 4 minutes of his point. But it was a really good one. Just to finish up what he said there, he went into exactly what you were saying, which is that when he came up as a pitcher, you didn't throw as hard as you could on every pitch. You saved it for that one big spot. Now I got two on and two out, and I need a bit. And that's when you would rear back and throw 100. But you, the rest of the time, you didn't pitch that way. And then you heard the stuff there about the pitching labs where their elbows. And the other point that he made in this that I thought was really interesting was he said in his day, which isn't that long ago, in his day, if there were 10 arm injuries for pitchers, 9 were shoulders and 1 was an elbow. Now, clearly, that's been reversed. 9 are elbows and 1 is a shoulder. So clearly something has changed. Clearly it's having a significant impact on injuries in the sport. And he's, if you listen to that whole thing, never once does he say, and by the way, we're pitching 5 seconds faster in between every pitch than we did before.
Yeah, the pitch clock is very low on the list of reasons why this is happening. He made some excellent points there. He mentioned the pitching labs as being great for pitchers, but also sort of a curse in some way. That is an outstanding point to amplify. Pitching labs, like you hear all these terms like Driveline and other companies like this, where pitchers will go in the offseason and they will, with all the fancy technology that they have, shape the way that a pitcher might change, add velocity or shape their breaking balls and things of that nature. What that does is very clear. It makes you a much better pitcher. Many, many pitchers have improved considerably by doing that. But what we now know, of course, is that those things lead to arm injuries. So at what expense, I ask, at what expense are you willing to add 2 or 3 miles an hour of velocity in an offseason and add more shape to your sweeper? Are you willing to risk the fact that your elbow is going to blow out after 2 starts like it just did for Shane Bieber? The problem is that it's all about incentives and there really is no solution because Major League Baseball teams are not going to be willing to take a lesser than pitcher that is going to tell you, whose agent is going to tell you that he has a better chance of staying healthy. I don't care how healthy you are. If you're not maximizing your output, I would rather have guys blowing cheese. I want someone coming in 98 out of the bullpen in the 5th inning because that's my best chance of winning that game.
Right.
The only chance for this to actually get fixed, and by the way, it has no chance of getting fixed, is if Major League Baseball and the union meet in the middle and figure out a plan over the next 8, 10, 12 years to remedy this from the youth levels all the way up.
How?
How would that happen?
Yeah.
Well, Tony Clark and Rob Manfred would need to exchange numbers, okay? And then they could start talking from there.
No, I get it, but what could they do? I understand that their toxic relationship is an impediment to this. But the one thing I've never been able to criticize any sport for doing is the people in any sport is trying as hard as they can to win. Like, their job is to try and win. It's not to protect the elbows of 15-year-old kids. So they're just trying to win. So what is it they could do? Let me hold this thought.
I've got 2 things for you, and I think you're going to like both.
I want
you
to come back on the other side of a break and share them.
Okay.
We'll do that. I have a bunch of other football in the hopper as well. And we've got group trivia, so let's go.
There are 4 quarterbacks drafted number 1 overall that won at least 100 regular season NFL games. You're going to give me all 4 number 1 overall picks at quarterback to win 100 games in their NFL career.
Does this have to begin with the common draft?
This is all time, but all 4 of these guys have been drafted. Like, we're not talking. I'm not going back to the 20s and 30s here.
Okay, I understand it, but it's in the common draft.
These are all common draft.
Common draft. Okay, because that is a delineation. Number 1 overall anyway. Okay, never mind. Because I was thinking of Bart Starr as a sneaky one, but of course he was drafted in the 17th round, so not particularly close to number 1 overall. The answer is next on ESPN Radio.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors. I do, you do, we all do, big, small. And when we keep them bottled up, as I sometimes have had happen in the past, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. It's helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. It isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Greeny today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Greeny, GREENY.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sports book bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
Now, let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac, weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And, boom! Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good! The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Greeny, the podcast.
All right, Greeny with you, presented by Progressive Insurance. So much going on. Let's start with the sneaky hemorrhoid. A really good question. We all like it a lot. Repeated, please.
I'm looking at a list. That list is most quarterback wins by player drafted number one overall. Among players on that list, four quarterbacks drafted the first pick have at least 100 regular season wins, and you're going to have to give me all four.
And you were telling us during the break there were a bunch of 99s.
There's a 99, a 90, two 98s, and two 94s. So it was a very congested leaderboard.
So there's a bunch of people that were super close.
Mm-hmm.
So the names we have written down so far are Terry Bradshaw, Peyton Manning, Eli Manning, John Elway, Matt Stafford, Alex Smith, and Carson Palmer. And the fact that we didn't even write down Troy Aikman's name is probably a mistake, but I'm almost positive he didn't win enough. Right? We don't think Aikman won 100 games. Is that right?
It was so short.
There's no question Peyton and Eli both did. Right? I mean, we're 100%
certain.
I think we lock all three in.
Elway's definitely 100.
Listen, guys, I know that I brought up Bradshaw and you guys are kind of questioning it. How could Terry Bradshaw not have won 100 regular season games? He was the starting quarterback in Pittsburgh.
Well, how long was he there?
At least...
Probably like 12 years.
12 years? What do you mean only? I mean 12 years. They only played 14 games in a season then, but I mean they had multiple years. If he's not 100, he's going to be like the 99 or the 98.
He's definitely up there.
But we don't like Matt Stafford better, right? Because they had so many terrible years in Detroit.
Yeah, I mean I like Brad. Personally, I think Bradshaw's our best guess. I haven't heard of another
Can
one.
Can we get confirmation on the other three?
Stafford, Alex Smith. Confirmation
Peyton,
on
Eli and Elway.
All right, we think Peyton, Eli, and Elway all have to be on it.
Those are all correct.
Okay.
Peyton Manning's at 186, John Elway at 148, and Eli Manning at 117.
Okay. So we're right on those three.
So those were 1, 2, and 3?
That's right.
Okay.
So now so the names we have here are Bradshaw, Aikman, Palmer, Alex Smith, and Matt Stafford. We're not forgetting anybody, right? Cam Newton wouldn't have won 100 games.
Nope.
Just thinking of quarterbacks who went one overall. Most of the people, I mean, no one still playing aside from Stafford. You just have to have been around too long. And none of these guys have been that I can think of, unless there's someone we're not thinking of. Vinny Testaverde?
No.
He was a starter for a trillion years with a bunch of different teams.
He was on so many bad teams.
He was on so many teams.
There's no way he got to 100.
Yeah, their teams were really bad in Tampa.
And
as an aside, every name you've mentioned right so far is between 90 and 107. So you guys are all over this, but there's someone with 107.
So we have the right name.
You have all the right names. You've peppered the top of the leaderboard.
107, man.
I mean, if I had, if you told me right now I have to be the one, and the fact that they're all that close suggests to me that we don't know. We're just guessing because they're all close to right. If you had just thrown these names at me and said, which of these players won the most regular season games, I would have guessed Terry Bradshaw. But the truth is, he's also the only one who played in the 14-game regular season era, which takes away two opportunities to win a year. That's, over the course of 12 years, that's 24 games he didn't get a chance to win. So that obviously does matter. So that's my only hesitation. So which one are we going with? Someone make a call.
I think you have to make a call.
Why do I have to make a call?
Because it's your show.
Brandon Jack offered anything?
Absolutely nothing.
Brandon and Pineapple Jack?
I don't think it's Palmer, Testaverde, or Aikman. I think it's Smith, Bradshaw, or Stafford.
All right, so Jack is saying he likes Stafford, and Brandon is saying Testaverde. So we eliminate them.
I like Terry Bradshaw.
Stafford was so on such bad teams. I know he's had a couple, you know, really good years. He won a Super Bowl, but 107 is so many for the Lions over like a 13-year span.
I'm not sure the Lions have. I mean, how many games has he won in L.A. though? Is the question. They won a bunch of games this year.
Yeah, he's won like 28 games in L.A.
I think we got, in the interest of moving this along, we got to pick one. Someone pick one. Bubba, you're the producer. Pick one.
I'll stick with Greeny. Let's go Bradshaw.
All right, we're going Terrence Bradshaw.
The correct answer is Terry Bradshaw.
Oh! Yeah, take that, Cam.
Yeah. That's
wow. Cam, who would you have chosen?
Apologize, Cam.
If it was all up to you, Cam, who would you have taken?
Where is Alex Smith?
Okay, Alex Smith is at 99.
Oh, I was so right there.
Alex Smith at 99. Bledsoe and Stafford at 98.
I forgot Bledsoe.
Oh, Bledsoe, wow.
Aikman and Steve Young at 94. Carson Palmer at 92.
So wait, Steve Young counts? He was a supplemental pick.
He's on my list, but he if he had been more than 100, I would have taken that into account.
I understand.
And then Vinny Testaverde has 90.
Wow. That's a great question.
Nice job, guys.
You've had two. That question and the TV question today were genuinely excellent questions. Okay, now let's circle back again to what we were talking about a few minutes ago so I can reset the topic for those just joining us. The topic is pitchers' elbow injuries. The Baseball Players Association, because they just want to do this, are trying to make it seem like the pitch clock has a lot to do with this. I think, and Hembo strongly thinks, that if the pitch clock has anything to do with it, it is a minuscule part of it. That the reality is these pitching labs where they're teaching these guys to throw in unorthodox ways, which is putting torque on their elbow, and the never-ending search for more velocity, guys throwing 100 basically from the first pitch of the game, have completely changed this to a point where, as Ben McDonald said, it used to be shoulder injuries for players, and now it is exclusively elbow injuries for pitchers. So, Hembo, you were going to say, so the question is there something we can do about it? Is there something that baseball and the players could get together and agree upon that we think would diminish these injuries? And the answer is?
Yes and no. Two things I'm going to put forth. One of them, your idea, and a great idea. Remind people your what they're calling the double hook, attaching the starting pitcher to the DH and why you like it.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's the idea. If you're going to try and attach, and mine was less about injury than it is about, but I think it would actually have this, it would be an unintended consequence of it in a positive way.
It would.
For me, it's more about, if you think about the things that have made baseball great through its history, it is not having the third guy in the bullpen come out and get you two outs by throwing 11 pitches that are all 100 miles an hour. What makes baseball great is that legendary starter still in the game in the eighth, in the ninth, facing the other team's cleanup hitter, or what used to be the cleanup hitter. Now they're leading off. But you know what I'm saying? That the starting pitcher has become an endangered species, or worse, it's become an irrelevant factor. And that's terrible. I mean, that's just a terrible thing for the sport. So if every team starts every game with a designated hitter, and the moment their starting pitcher is no longer in the game, you no longer have the pitcher, whoever your pitcher is, has to bat the rest of the way, it would have to have some impact on how quickly you change pitchers.
It would. Would you be willing to consider a revision in which if a pitcher under this rule of yours reached 5 innings, 6 innings, 7 innings, whatever innings threshold you set, you get your DH for the entirety of the game.
Yes, because that might actually further increase the chance of it happening.
Mm-hmm.
So would we want it to be judged by outs, by pitches, or by innings?
Well, outs and innings would be, in effect, the same. So let's say if you can finish 6 innings, so
it
get 18 outs.
It wouldn't be necessarily
outs.
Exactly the same. But let's just say, because I was thinking in my head, I was thinking of 20 outs.
Oh, I
so,
see.
You know what I mean? Like, if you get 20 outs.
6 2/3.
Now you want to bring someone in with 2 on and 2 out in the 7th. I can live with that.
Okay.
So that's, I was actually thinking that. And 20 is a nice round number. It sounds better than 18 outs or something like that. So I think 20 outs. Let's just use that as a straw man. Yes, I would, because I think if you knew, you might be inclined to leave the pitcher in there another 1 or 2 innings.
You might.
If you know you're going to get to keep your designated hitter as a result of it. So I think it would actually have a further unintended positive consequence.
So we're going to enact your idea. Here is mine. And this is an idea being bandied about across the league right now, I know for sure. A maximum number of pitchers that a team is permitted to use in a 9-inning game.
Okay. So, yes. And that is where you will start getting all of the blowback and all of the pushback, because it will seem so contrived. That will seem much more... Look, I'm totally in favor of it. But when they started instituting, well, a pitcher must face a certain number of batters or record a certain number of outs before you can change pitchers a single time, I remember just how strong the pushback to that idea was, because you're forcing someone to leave someone in a game if that someone just doesn't have it, right? If you throw someone out there and that someone can't find the plate, you're not letting the manager try as hard as he can to win the game. So maybe your idea is a better one. If we're going to play 9 innings, we're going to have, is our number going to be 4?
My number would be 4 or 5. Before the game, both managers and thus everyone watching on TV knows.
Designate, these are my 4 pitchers in this game. If it goes to a 10th inning, you get a 5th. It goes to an 11th inning, you get a 6th, and on it goes.
And we could also have some potential provisions for blowouts. Let's say the game reaches a place where one team has a 10-run lead on another. I'm just thinking about situations like that. Obviously, if a pitcher is injured, things like that.
Well, if a team has a 10-run lead, they can always pitch the second baseman.
That's true, too.
Right? I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like,
so position players wouldn't count towards your list.
Right.
Fair enough. I think that would go a long way in elongating starters.
What you would do is you would take all your position players, and then you would add 4 pitchers and say, this is my active roster, sort of like football does with, you know, the guys who are not active for that
sure.
game. The other pitchers are not active. You can activate 1 in the 10th inning, 1 in the 11th inning, and on.
This is my idea, because what you will then do is, in some sense, elevate the most important and most endangered species in your sport. If you are only able to use 3 or 4 relievers in a given game, you are not going to pull your starter if he's allowed 2 runs after throwing 84 pitches in the 5th inning, because you're not going to be able to afford to do that, no matter how good your bullpen is. And that, I think, would be a great idea. Might you cost some sort of specialists their job in the bullpen? Yes. But what you would also then do is considerably elevate, both financially and otherwise, the importance of the starting pitcher. And if Major League Baseball is able to do that, then there would be a trickle-down effect in the minors and in college and in high school and all the way down, because you would have more incentive to build stamina to get to 100 pitches and beyond without maxing out.
I'm in.
You like it?
Oh, I love it. I don't know why anyone wouldn't like it. The people who are not going to like it are the people who are just resistant to change of any kind. See, I'm thinking back to this. Bubba, do me a favor. Pull up all the mea culpas that we got last year for everyone who was complaining about Rob Manfred and the pitch clock and how it was devastating, the worst thing that ever happened to baseball. This is the worst thing. Terrible decision. Rob Manfred, he hates the sport. He doesn't care about the sport at all. All the people who were saying that before last season began. Can you pull up all the columns and all the rants and all the talk shows and everyone who apologized to him? Oh, don't bother, because it didn't happen. No one ever does it. No one ever wants to give the guy credit. Again, I don't do public relations for Rob Manfred. I don't care if you like him or not. It doesn't make any difference to me. But for some reason, no one ever wants to give him credit for having had a good idea. This was an idea that was so overdue in the sport. He finally enacted it, and the players acted like this was some slap in their face, which is ludicrous, because they don't have any understanding or concern about the long-term betterment of the game. They're only concerned about themselves in that moment, which I get. I understand why you would be. You're worried about making your money when you can. But the reality is there wasn't any good reason not to do it, and it has made the game a million times better.
You mentioned the three-batter minimum. When was the last time you watched a baseball game and complained aloud that that exists?
Right.
You just forget it exists.
Right.
It's just how the game should be. That's all Major League Baseball would be doing, because an ideal baseball game does not include 11 pitchers. It includes two or three. What year would you say you first fell in love with baseball? Or what summer?
1975.
1975. So I'm looking this up. In the year 1975, there were 1,052 complete games pitched across baseball. 1,052. How many complete games would you guess there were thrown last season?
I mean, less than 1% of that.
35.
Okay, so like 3%.
Like one per team. They each play 162 games.
I'm surprised it was even 35. I was going to say something like 15. Were any of those rain shortened?
In 2020, there were rain shortened or seven inning complete games, because they changed some of the games to seven innings, you recall, for the doubleheaders.
Right.
But either way, there's been one this year. I don't know that we're ever getting back to a place where we're going to get 1,000 complete games in a season, but we are in a place now where teams don't have any obvious reason to invest money in starting pitching, and then you can't sell your fight. If you go to Major League Baseball's scoreboard page on ESPN.com, like I do every single day, and I look at the pitching matchups, I'll be honest with you. You don't know anyone that loves baseball more than I do, but very few of those excite me. But that's your card. That's your card. Who the starting pitchers are that day should be an enormous attraction. I know I'm going to get a chance to see Mike Trout hit four times or Aaron Judge hit four times. I get that. Maybe I'll get the chance to see Mariano Rivera pitch the ninth. But when I show up at the ballpark, I want to know that the person that is starting on the mound is going to at least pay my ticket. And right now that happens so infrequently.
Right. You want to be excited about who that person is, mm-hmm. and we're losing that in the sport. And so, I'm all for it. Bubba, you love baseball. The other night you were texting us all about you were watching the Mets while we were all waiting for the interminable delay before the college basketball. They got to change that, by the way. They got to change what time they tip off the national championship game.
Please.
Right? I mean, I was so happy to see the women outdraw them, just so maybe they consider changing that.
Well, I mean, the crazy thing is it's not new. They've been starting at post-9 for like 30 years.
I know.
It's always been
unbelievable. If baseball started a World Series,
it definitely hasn't always been like that. Like, I don't know when they started doing it. It definitely hasn't always been like that. Going back to my childhood, it wasn't always like that. When Michael Jordan played Patrick Ewing, someone looked that up. 1982, men's NCAA national championship game, North Carolina, Georgetown, the famous Fred Brown game. What time was the opening?
Well, it was definitely at least in 86, because someone had a screenshot of CBS, and it was Duke Louisville, 1986, and it said CBS, 9 p.m.
Really?
So from
that's Purvis Ellison. That's exactly. The first Coach K team.
Yeah, from 86 on, it's been 9 p.m. Now, I don't know if they hopefully started right at 9, which is, you know, instead of 9:25, which does help a little bit, but still, it's been 9 or later since 86, which is insane.
That's unbelievable to me.
Yeah, I mean, and we saw, you know, Monday Night Football has moved earlier, Sunday Night Football moved earlier. Baseball mover. Everyone's moving earlier except for this. It's weird. I don't get it.
Very strange. We needed Zach Edey actually in that Celtics-Bucks game yesterday because we needed more fouls.
More free throws. Anyway, Bubba, what do you think of the idea that Hembo has here?
I like the DH thing for sure. I do like starting with that. I don't really know how to explain. It just seems too kind of wacky and
contrived.
Yeah, contrived.
That's what I was going to. But I do like to hear the people are going to say it's contrived.
But I do like the DH part, because I do think there should be some thing to let's keep our starters in there. I would like to start with that and see what happens. But I do agree to Hembo's point, where at first I was like, oh, it's so stupid to have the three batter rule. Mm-hmm. But now I forgot about it. You know, you're just like, all right, well, I don't even remember that's a thing anymore. So if we were to institute Hembo's thing, I probably would forget about it don't even realize that's the rule anymore. So from that point, he's probably correct. But I would rather start with the DH thing first.
Okay, it's an interesting idea. You know what? I'm distracted because I'm just trying to think, is there any way we can get Chris Russo over here? He is across the hall doing First Take, but he's on till the end of the show. So we can't. I would be interested to hear someone like him someone like Costas, you know, one of the sort of sage, older-headed voices of the sport, and get a perspective from them, because that would be a monstrous change. I mean, I guess the pitch clock was a monstrous change, but it really wasn't, which is to say, they didn't really fundamentally change anything except for how quickly the game would move along, and it always used to move along that fast anyway. They never had a restriction on how many pitchers could pitch.
But you now, never needed one.
Because no one would ever have thought to do it.
Have needed to do it. I mean, where we are though now.
Right.
The average postseason.
Well, it's really
game.
That they didn't think to do it.
Well, sure.
They didn't need to do it. It never occurred to anyone.
I'm going
to
look up in the break. The average postseason game lately, how many pitchers have been used? That's going to be an astronomical number.
We'll come back with that and more as we continue on ESPN Radio.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPNpods. That's amazon.com/ESPNpods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
Greeny, the podcast. This is Greeny.
Hembo pronounced the word M-E-M-E as Meme. How is it possible that no one has spoken that word aloud in your presence?
I just sounded it out. I don't know.
Why are you sounding out words that are commonly used by society, the world in which you live?
This is just me twice, right? Two syllables.
It's not two syllables.
Meme.
It's one word. It is a meme. Everyone on planet Earth calls it a meme.
This is Greeny.
There's so many things I need to figure out here. So many things that need to be explained to the members of the hashtag crew. We're just not the brightest bunch. Mostly Hembo. Hembo manages somehow to be both the smartest and the dumbest of us. And that's quite a trick. I'll give you a lot of credit.
And not a lot of people overlap in that Venn diagram.
That's true.
I managed to.
You're exactly right. You
it's
are
a superpower.
You're one of one. That's your superpower.
Some might say it's my superpower.
To both be the most and least knowledgeable person I've ever met in my entire life.
I really
life.
Want that eidetic memory. Bad.
There are so many things that you know that, well, here's the thing. All the things you know are generally things most people could go without knowing.
Their whole life.
And there are so many things you don't know that everyone else does.
What would I have done if ESPN didn't hire me?
I don't know. Like what would you have done? If you weren't doing this job, what would you be doing?
I have no other...
Didn't you major in like education?
Skill. I have a master's degree in education.
Would you be teaching?
But you didn't even... You thought I was the least qualified person to supervise children just last week.
Well, particularly your own.
So who's hiring me to do that job?
Well, I don't know. Why did you get a master's in education?
Just because LaSalle paid for it.
But you could have gotten a master's in anything?
Not that expediently.
Well, I mean... there were no other one-year master's programs?
There were not. I did it based upon the time, the credit.
Okay.
And I also probably couldn't have passed the MBA classes. I mean, that's not really my language.
No. I don't know that you have a language. anyway, we were going to get into the Masters here because my favorite sporting event of the year begins tomorrow. I've said it before and I'll say it again. If you told me that I could only watch one sporting event per year on television, of course, it would break my heart because I would hate to miss all the other wonderful things. But if you forced me to just pick one, I would pick this one. My love for the game, my love for playing the game and for the game itself has only grown and intensified over the course of time. My passion for the professional version of the game has been greatly impacted and greatly diminished by what has happened with the split and the extraordinary greed that has been displayed by everyone involved since this whole live thing began. So we were just, I was on the golf course the other day. I was just having this conversation with someone. The question was, do you watch less golf now? And the answer, every single one of us, we're talking about four guys. It was, the feels like temperature was 31 degrees on Saturday morning. And all of us got up at 6 a.m. on a Saturday to play. So, you know, we love the game. And every one of us said, yes, I find myself watching less of it. So it'll be interesting to see, as the Masters rolls around, do I have the same level of passion for it, particularly if it's Rahm or Brooks or, I don't know, I mean, should I say Phil? I mean, Phil is basically, he's not even playing the game at this point that we became accustomed to, but he plays so well on that golf course. Could that happen? It'll be interesting to see if that impacts the way I feel about it.
I mean, John Rahm won it just last year. He was still a PGA Tour member, though, at that point, right?
Right.
He just came since then. So right. I guess that's the
The only major that has been won by an active member of LIV was when Koepka won. What did he win last year? The PGA?
Yeah. Did Cam Smith not? I want to say there was a Cam Smith here, but I could be wrong.
Cam Smith finished second in the British Open.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Maybe I'm thinking of him having already committed to them. And me rooting against
there
him.
There was all of this very speculation foggy that he was about to commit
maybe
to
that
them,
was it. Maybe that was it.
But he hadn't done it yet. Everyone kind of knew he was going, but he didn't. Why am I blanking on the other majors last year? Good God. Who won the U.S. Open last year? Give me the majors last year.
I don't have
year.
The eidetic memory. I told you. This is my superpower.
What you have are very fast fingers.
I do have fast fingers. Just give me a second. By the way, I picked the Masters correctly in two of the last 3 years.
Wyndham Clark won the U.S.
Oh, that's
Open
right.
last year.
Wyndham Clark ran away and hid, and he's still very much on the PGA Tour, and he had a heartbreaking lip out on the 72nd hole to the Players a couple of weeks ago.
I love his name.
I love his name, and I really enjoy watching him play, too. He's a terrific player to watch. And then who won the British?
By the way, if I offered you, because you asked this to... It was Curtis Strange today on the TV show. Scotty or the field, right? That was the question that you asked
him? I would
take
the field.
Yeah, you'd have to.
In golf, you have to take
I mean,
the field.
It's plus 475. I mean, like that. Even Tiger wasn't, you know, odds on at any point to win a golf tournament.
I might have considered Tiger.
Sure.
At his apex. I would not do it with Scheffler, especially because there are weeks that you don't even know what direction he's putting the ball in. Who won the British Open last year?
Brian Harman.
Oh, that's right. Brian Harman. So the only one, the only player who was already a LIV Tour player to win a major was Koepka last
gotcha.
Year. But it's going to happen again.
So
it's definitively going to happen. Now that they have Rahm, mm-hmm. it's certainly going to happen again.
I did a bunch of research earlier this week in preparation to bet the Masters, and my list spit out a lot of the usual suspects in terms of who I'm going to bet on to win, and some non-usual ones. I have picked the Masters champion two of the last 3 years. So obviously, Scottie Scheffler is number one on this list, but you're only getting plus 475. There's no value there. John Rahm at 12-1, there's also not too much value, but he just won the thing, and you know he's hitting it great right now. I'm going to give you three other really interesting names.
I think Rahm, if you made me pick one player, I would pick Rahm.
Going back to back.
Yes.
Okay, interesting. I've got Xander Schauffele at 14-1. I've got him.
He's knocking on the door of majors. It feels like every time it never closes the deal.
He's been playing great this
year. He's great. He's a great player.
What I effectively did, looked at the last few years, who was consistently great there and who's hitting it great now.
He was right there that one year. I forget who he was competing with at the Masters on the back nine, and he put it in the water on 16. I forget, but he was right there with a chance to win maybe 3-4 years ago.
He plays great on that course. I have Matsuyama on my list here at 18-1, having won it 3 years ago. He's kind of gotten back to playing great now,
yeah.
So don't be surprised if he's in it. And then a sneaky pick at 45-1, Shane Lowry. Shane Lowry at 45-1 is worth a few shekels. He's playing great golf right now and has very sneakily played really consistently well there the last few years. So if you're going to ask me for like a long shot, put in your bankroll. I like Lowry at 45-1.
He won the British Open. I want to say he won it at Portrush when it was there. So what is that? 3 years ago? 2 years ago? However many years ago the British Open was at Portrush. The Open Championship was at Portrush.
In 2019, he won.
He won it there. So mm-hmm. that's 5 years. Oh my God, that's 5 years. How does time go by this quickly?
COVID changed everything for me.
I guess. I mean, it just seems to me. But one way or another, I'm certainly looking forward to it. Whatever my feelings are about the LIV thing, it would still be the one event of the year I wouldn't miss. We'll have the coverage for you tomorrow and Friday. CBS has it Saturday and Sunday. It's the best event of the year.
And so your play would be John Rahm at 12-1?
Yes. Well, I mean, I like the idea of getting some longer odds in a couple of other places. But if you asked me who do I think is going to win, I would say John Rahm.
And your concern with Scotty is the putter.
I think that also Rahm is very focused on proving I'm still the best player in the world. He's not on the tour anymore. He still thinks he's the best player in the world, and he may not be wrong. We'll see you tomorrow, ESPN Radio.
Thanks for listening to Greeny, the podcast. You can listen live each weekday morning at 10 Eastern on ESPN Radio. Or watch the show through the Watch tab on the ESPN app. Also catch Greeny on Get Up, weekday mornings at 8 on ESPN, and also available wherever you get your podcast.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.